The Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Jason Phipps. On this week's show,
the aim is to allow people with ideas to take it to destinations near and far and to make it as easy to find space for your idea as it is to book a hotel room.
Jemima Kish, The Guardian's digital media correspondent, meets Ross Bailey, the precocious web entrepreneur, to discuss his attempt to reshape the high street with his site, appearhere.co.uk. And
my visit to the Cyber Addiction Recovery Centre left me more mindful of the ways that technology gets in the way of my work life. And also,
we'll have an email from America as Alex Krotowski muses on the topic of cyber addiction and her own relationship with technology. We'll have a tech news roundup, including the Secret Service in the UK teaming up with the commercial sector to combat future cyber attacks. And Yahoo buys Sumly and makes a teenager very, very happy. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. To say that something's the Airbnb of is turning into the default description of a myriad of new digital services. But the website appearhere.co.uk really is the Airbnb of retail space. Jemima Kish met up with its founder, Ross Bailey, to find out more.
I'm Jemima Kish, digital media correspondent, and I'm with Ross Bailey, who is one of those people destined to make you feel like a real underachiever. He's 21. He's already spent 6 months working with Peter Jones as part of an intensive enterprise academy. He's launched his own businesses. He's had T-shirts he designed banned from Buckingham Palace and launched a shop in just 10 days. Welcome to the Tech Weekly podcast.
Thanks, Jemima.
So your latest business then is called Appear Here, which is essentially a listing site for pop-up shops. So tell us the concept and how it came about.
So Appear Here is a marketplace that connects landlords' vacant space to basically anyone with a great idea. The aim is to allow people with ideas to take it to destinations near and far and to make it as easy to find space for your idea as it is to book a hotel room. You know, there's loads of sites at the moment where you can find places all over the world to stay overnight. We want you to be able to find space all over the world to launch your brand and your business.
You're the Airbnb of pop-up shops.
Yeah, some people have said that.
So tell us what it looks like when you go to the site.
So at the moment when you go to the site, it's you can go on there and you can put in the destination that you want to appear in, and you also put your duration and your disappear date. We then have a nationwide network at the moment of spaces, over 100 spaces, and we've only been online for about 6 weeks. It's really exciting. And our team at the moment match that inventory to you by sending you listing and sort of opening up the portal to you once your inquiry comes through.
Do you work with commercial estate agents then to draw up these listings?
We do work with a couple of commercial agents. We actually mainly work with the space owner. So the landlord actually comes to us, and they tell us the space they've got available, and then we match them directly to the person who's got a great idea. And going on to when I was mentioning the site before, saying about that inquiry, actually soon you're going to be able to go through that site and you won't be sending an inquiry, you'll just be searching by destinations and you'll find that space you want to appear in or that centre, and you'll literally click some dates to appear and we'll make it happen.
There are so many property sites, though. Is there really enough demand for this? I mean, it's quite a fickle industry. There's been a lot of people investing in the property industry that have had their fingers burnt. Do we really need another site?
So what's really interesting is with residential property, about 90-something percent of people looking for a residential property go online first. In commercial property, it's completely flipped around. And actually, there's no real sites online even for listing commercial property. And the ones that are available, if you look at them, are really poor compared to what's in the residential market. So what we're doing is bringing a new platform to the commercial property sector, specifically retail. But we're also not looking at it as a listing site. We're looking at it as a site that allows you to rent any space, but where there's an audience. So it's a bit like me looking at us like a cross between a marketplace and a media company.
The economy's not in a brilliant place. Does that mean that there's more or less demand for pop-up shops? And there's obviously huge concern among councils about empty space on high streets. So are there any sort of financial advantages for landlords to allow and encourage pop-up shops?
Well, there's a couple of things. The high street is, to a certain extent, dying, right? 14.2% of the high street's empty. They're saying that figure could go up with the recent retailers that have gone into administration. And what we are finding is that these spaces are sitting empty for a long period of time. But even before this period, there were still always void rates, right? But it's now just gone higher than ever before. And what's happening is that landlords aren't able to fill those spaces. Online retail as well. So it's not just about the economy. Online retail has taken a large proportion, not a large proportion, but a proportion of sales, and it's only getting stronger. And what we're trying to do is say to landlords, we need to look at where retail is going in the future. And if physical retail is to still have a place, it needs to be about entertainment and engagement, because the only thing you get in physical retail that you don't get online is that human interaction and the chance to see, touch, feel, and experience. So we look at these spaces a bit like, I call them awkward pauses. And when you have a conversation with someone, if there's an awkward pause, you get bored, you move on, right? So we try and take this awkward pause, put people's ideas in there, and get the conversation going again. And with the economy right now from the, I guess, the demand side of the brands and the people with ideas going into that space, I think the pop-up shops give them an amazing opportunity to test that, use that space as an incubator, to test a new location, an audience, a product, gain constant feedback from the consumer for relatively little cost.
How much understanding is there among landlords for this kind of experiential kind of incubator model? They want cold, hard cash, don't they?
Do you know, I actually feel that if we'd had this conversation 6 months ago, I would have agreed. And when I spoke to landlords initially, they sort of were like, yeah, but look, we want to be this, that space for us to be earning, and we've got a retail value on that and blah, blah, blah. And they talk about how every square foot of space, there's a value there because of the turnover that can be achieved. When actually we're saying, look at that square feet of space and look at the audience and the people that you're bringing there, and don't value a square foot, don't value each square foot of retail space by the turnover, but instead value it by who's there in one sense. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And landlords are now becoming really receptive to the idea. They're actually getting in touch with us. We've, like I said, we've got over 100 spaces at the moment. It's growing each week. And a lot of the time it's landlords coming direct. And a lot of them are saying, actually, yes, earning money on that space is important, but this can help save us rates. It can help save us costs. But more than anything, if we, especially big landlords that own big chunks of high streets or own shopping centres, are saying this brings entertainment. It drives new brands that would never have come here before. It allows the next generation who have an idea to compete and to sort of feed little surprises into that shopping monoculture. And it keeps us relevant.
And how about charities? Because it seems like if landlords are inclined to explore new ideas, they might be more open to philanthropic ideas. So just letting a charity have a space and seeing what they can do with it.
There's some great companies around actually at the moment, like Free Space and different organisations that allow people purely to rent shops for charities. And they're sort of like agencies that take these spaces and match them to third sector businesses. And I think that's great. And what's really interesting is that empty spaces, if you get a charity in there, I think you get something like an 80% rates reduction. So it's in the landlord's interest. At the same point, I mean, we don't want to see the high street just full of charity shops. And what we're doing is hopefully saying that sort of little guy with a new idea can also be in there alongside those guys.
You've obviously managed to convince some fairly impressive investors, Ballpark, Forward, and some angel investors too. Tell us how much funding you've had, how many people you've got on board, and what your kind of timescales are, what you'll be doing next.
So, yeah, it was really exciting to get Forward, Ballpark Ventures. We also have got some guys that have invested in some really cool British retailers, like Brewer and Calf Kidson, who have also invested. So our next steps are about proving that user journey of going onto a site and booking a commercial real estate property works. It's about making sure the product is seamless in that sense, and about increasing the inventory and making sure that we can find a scalable way of doing that, which I think we're nearly there. And then once we hit a few of those milestones, it's then going to be about, I guess, accelerating that so we can really make this happen, that people can take their idea all over the world.
OK, I'm sure it's going to be a great success because you've already been involved in several quite interesting projects. But tell us about the Peter Jones Enterprise Academy and how you ended up doing that at 16.
So I don't remember how I ended up going there, but I remember that I left school at about, 16. And Peter had, he wanted to set up a school. And he had conversations, I think he was saying, with Philip Green about how Philip Green had done this for fashion. And he was like, well, I want to do this for entrepreneurs. And Peter has been a really strong believer that entrepreneurs aren't born. There isn't this sort of magic person that's born that believes that they can run a business, that actually it's you'll learn and you're taught the, you know, whatever skills he believes an entrepreneur should have, anyone can have them. So a lot of people applied for this Pathfinder course that he did, and he picked 20 of us, 20 or 25. We lived in a hotel for 6 months, and like you said, and
great parties, I'm imagining.
Yeah, no, sadly there wasn't, but it was good that, I guess, moving out of home for the first time, you still had someone making your bed and cooking you dinner. But so we went to this school, this hotel. We were taught by Peter a few times, his team, and he got a great group of like entrepreneurs and people in there. And what was really amazing is you were taught by mentors and people that were in industry, not teachers. And we were always set live briefs every week and all of that. And it was an amazing experience for 6 months. And what Peter did is took what we learned and what had worked and what hadn't, created a curriculum. And now I believe they've got over 100 academies across the UK. And they're turning out something like thousands of graduates each year. So it's really changed in the last 3 or 4 years.
Amazing. Well, I think that's just the kind of thing we need more of within the national curriculum. So maybe there'll be a knock-on effect there. What can we expect to see next from appearhere.co.uk?
So soon you'll be able to go onto the site in the next few weeks and you'll be able to search by destinations. So you'll be able to look at key cities. You're going to be able to learn about their audience. You're going to see spaces and inventory. And you're going to be able to click on that space and literally, like booking a hotel room, select a space for you to appear in. We're also working with a few really exciting brands, including some big online retailers. So it's going to be really cool to see technology companies starting to come onto the high street. And actually, it's amazing how many of those really are becoming to value the importance of meeting people face to face. And hopefully, in the very long term, you're going to see a shopping centres and you're going to see high streets and stuff that are more entertaining and exciting, and where things are constantly changing and adapting, and there's sort of this experience and theatre happening, which right now isn't.
Ross Bailey, thank you very much. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to appearhere.co.uk.
This is the latest news from The Guardian's technology news desk. This week, it was announced that commercial cybersecurity experts are to operate alongside the intelligence agencies for the first time in an attempt to combat the growing online threat to Britain's firms. The government is establishing a new fusion cell where analysts from MI5 and GCHQ will work side by side with private sector counterparts. The cell is part of the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Partnership, launched on Wednesday of this week to provide industry with a forum to share details of techniques used by online attackers as well as methods of countering them. At any one time, there will be 12 to 15 analysts working at the cell, based at an undisclosed location in London. One senior official connected with the initiative said, "What the fusion cell will be doing is pulling together a single, richer intelligence picture of what is going on in cyberspace and the threats attacking the UK. What we are trying to do is get that better intelligence picture and push it out to industry in a way that they can take action on, so it's very action-orientated. Although the industry representatives will not have direct access to classified intelligence material, they will have to undergo security vetting." A 17-year-old London schoolboy has sold his app company to the internet giant Yahoo for an estimated $18 million. But he won't be moving to the company's California headquarters just yet, because he wants to finish his A-levels. Nick D'Aloisio from Wimbledon, South London, created the app called Sumly, which provides bite-sized summaries of content from news and other sites, a little over a year ago from his bedroom, and now joins an elite group of teenagers who have become internet millionaires. D'Aloisio, who is still too young to be director of his own firm, said he had begun tinkering with apps for mobile devices as a hobby and had not expected to profit from it. The money from the sale of the business will go into a trust fund, although he said he does intend to get a new computer, as well as some new trainers. "I'll be staying in London," said D'Aloisio. "I want to finish my A-levels, and I couldn't really live on my own out there." His mother, Diana D'Aloisio, appeared to be still somewhat in shock. "I knew he was a little out of the box, but I didn't expect it to happen all of a sudden like this," she said. The price tag is understood to be 18 million, 90% in cash and 10% in Yahoo shares, though other reports suggest the total could be up to 40 million. Neither D'Aloisio nor Yahoo would confirm the details of the deal. 3D movie technology may be nothing more than a, quote, phase, according to Oscar-winning British director Danny Boyle. On receiving an award for outstanding contributions to the film industry, Boyle said he was not a fan of stereoscope on film and doubted it would survive. He said, "I don't use 3D. I'm a spectacle wearer, so I hate going to 3D movies because you have to wear two pairs of spectacles, which makes you feel like even more of a prat. You know how everybody feels a bit of a prat wearing 3D spectacles? You, as a spectacle wearer, feel a double prat." Boyle admitted there was extraordinary work being carried out in 3D, describing some of the effects in Ang Lee's Oscar-winning Life of Pi as incredible. But he added, "It's a tool, you know. There are sound innovations coming, actually, particularly Dolby Atmos, which are going to do something very equivalent to what 3D does. So I don't know if 3D will survive, to be honest. I think it may be a phase." Boyle's comments place him in the opposite corner from filmmakers such as Avatar's James Cameron, who have embraced the 3D with messianic zeal. Until this week, there was a Swedish term for ungooglable, meaning impossible to find via web search. But that is no more. The Language Council of Sweden, which oversees the addition of official new words to the Swedish lexicon, had lined up ogooglabar, defined as something that cannot be found on the web using a search engine. But Google's lawyers got wind of the council's intentions and told it that the company did not want its trademark diluted by being used to apply to all searching. Instead, Google said, the definition should be something that cannot be found on the web using Google. And it should include a trademark notification, the search giant added. The council refused and simply dropped the word from its new additions. The term ugglabar had become a new notable word in Sweden during 2012, alongside emoji, emoticons used in instant messages, drinkorexia, an eating disorder involving barely eating while drinking alcohol instead, and conversasjukan, or converse disease, bad feet or posture caused by wearing trendy trainers. For all these news stories and more, just go to the best technology website on the web. That's guardian.co.uk/technology. But first, give your eyes a rest and your ears a workout with the Guardian Audio Edition.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Sean Ingle on the Tabata workout programme. Harder, faster, fitter, quicker. Kira Cochrane on the rise of the naked female warriors. And in our audio book review, we look at some of the best new fiction around, from Kate Atkinson and Ruth Ozeki. To subscribe for free to the Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Where is the line between a passion for all things digital and an obsession? When does a daily use of the web veer from fun and improving to draining and compulsive? In her first Email from America, Alex Krotowski takes a visit to LA's Cyber Addiction Center.
Los Angeles, California is a land of issues. Everybody's got a support group, a therapist, a yogi, or a coach of one description or another. It's actually rather contradictory. You'd think with the views, the beach, and the sunshine that their problems would melt away. But here in the land of celebrity, everyone's letting their problems all hang out. Unsurprisingly, in this free market, there's a thriving solution industry here to help, to confirm, through the exchange of cash for expertise, that it's not you,
It was you in a past life. Or it was your parents. Or your parents in a past life. Or your life is afflicted by a curse. Or by carbs. Or karma. Or cooked food. Or, as I saw riding past on the number one bus the other day, perhaps the thing that is most affecting your life is your pash for the web. The Cyber Addiction Recovery Center offers the therapeutic services of social worker Chris Mulligan, a clinician who's been helping people professionally for more than 15 years. His enormous sign on Washington Boulevard in Culver City, right next to the sound stages of Sony Pictures Entertainment, describes that he will help with internet and video game addiction in children, teens, and adults. Unsurprisingly, it attracts the interests of parents eager to extract their kids' unhealthy fixations with their tablets, smartphones, laptops, and games consoles. My interest was piqued for two reasons. First, although over the years I've been writing about technology, I've heard of net addiction clinics in China and Korea, one in the Netherlands, and a few scattered across the USA, I've never actually seen one. And here was one practically on my doorstep. Second, I've recently begun to question my relationship with my devices. Twitter and email have snuck into my good night and good morning routines. There's an almost physical reaction, panic mostly, when I can't access data on my phone or when Wi-Fi goes down. I can't concentrate on writing unless I turn on self-control, a piece of software I downloaded from the web when I was writing my last book. Self-control blacklists websites and services that I decide are too tempting, like Twitter and email. If it's not on, I'll switch task like a loon. And if it is, I have to turn my phone off and put it in another room, or I'll find a way around the online blockade to feed my need for what I don't even know. But is this kind of behavior the symptom of an addiction? Intellectually, my attitude to the phenomenon tends towards the skeptical end of the spectrum. Not a single psychiatric diagnostic manual in the world includes cyber addiction as an actual mental health problem, even though headlines, TV ads, and polemicists would have you believe that the fat pipes of the internet are the crack pipes of society. But the science does show that some people do develop problematic use, in the same way that some people overeat, overexercise, and yes, overread. So I decided to get an expert opinion. I made a phone call and booked myself in for a cyber addiction assessment at the Cyber Addiction Recovery Center. The sliding scale rate for a 90-minute individual session with a charmingly Facebook-friendable Chris Mulligan ranges from $90 to $120. I was welcomed into a large screenless room where the furniture arrangement implied group and individual therapy zones, and made my way to a couch on the far side. My voice echoed around the bare white windowless walls. Chris had only moved to this location a few weeks before and was still decorating, but this gave the atmosphere of a clinical pallor, which, given the reason why I was ostensibly there, seemed appropriate. We took the positions, me on the couch and he on the chair across. Self-published workbooks with titles like The Video Game Addiction Workbook and Parenting Cyberspace sat on the mid-century modern coffee table next to a jaunty vase of flowers. I took a deep breath. I was suddenly very nervous. I've come to find out if I'm addicted to the internet, I said. He smiled. I must have looked terrified, beseeching, and he sat back in his chair. He began, "Well, my first question is usually, what do you do for a living?" I told him I was a journalist and technology researcher, and then, unasked, flooded the room with my worries about concentration, my concerns about checking my phone at inappropriate and difficult times, my fears about oversharing on social networks. I confessed to using software to control my use and described the steps that I've taken to get around it. By the end of the, I don't know, it must have been 10-minute confession, I felt utterly shamed. I tried to explain that I had to use the technology. I had to be connected all the time because of the nature of my work, but my protests felt pathetic, like a condemned woman appealing for clemency from a benign ruler. I awaited his conclusion. I could almost hear the men in the white coats outside the door. He smiled again. He did that little spinning thing with the pen that he had in his hand, you know, the one that some people can do in the backs of their thumbs. "My next question," he said quietly, slowly, stilling his pen, "is do you feel it's getting in the way of your life?" This gave me pause. I wasn't skipping out on meals, social activities, meetings, or relationships to go online. I wasn't stealing to access the web. More than anything else, I was just concerned with my levels of productivity and the abusive way that I dealt with deadlines. I just knew that I was wasting my time click-switching from one tab to another, getting lost down unnecessary rabbit holes, spending hours writing and researching blog posts about things no one cared about, instead of doing the writing that I was meant to be doing. But as a procrastinator, I had always meant to get around to being disappointed with my time management. The web was just simply helping me fritter away the hours doing the things that were so-called useful instead of what actually needed to be done. I still generally hit my deadlines. I hadn't been fired yet for dropping the ball. I had to admit to him that I wasn't. "Do you play games?" Surprised by the question, I said I'd not picked up a game since 2009 except for a radio documentary that I made last year. He made a note on his piece of paper. "Do you look at online porn?" "No," I said. "Not really." He took off his glasses and looked at me. He made another mark with his pen, and he then put the pen down. And then we had a conversation. The people that Chris treats for problematic behavior play games, look at porn, gamble, blog, or they manipulate social media to the exclusion of everything else. They've lost relationships. They're losing touch with reality. Their behavior, he says, and what they're doing or looking at escalates. It becomes more dangerous. They take risks. What I suffer from is easy to deal with. I can get a machine that can only be connected to the internet with an Ethernet cable, or I could use self-control or similar services that are human-controlled that remotely switch off access to certain sites. If I'm really worried that I'm losing control, I should make a mark on a piece of paper every time I check Twitter or my email, switch tabs, or check my phone, and I should do this for 10 days. Then I should reassess. But he's not worried about me because I don't play games and I don't look at porn. I don't gamble. These are the biggest red flags, he explained. Games and gambling services are designed to compel, to keep people playing. Porn doesn't allow people to look away. But even these statements are contentious. Last week, the Academy of Social Sciences gave Dr. Mark Griffiths of Nottingham Trent University an award for his work in this field. Over the years, Mark has been forced by many computer games developers and journalists to play the role of the pantomime baddie, making claims against their specialist subjects and puncturing their inflated geek egos with some actual science. They don't like his results, which generally show that people who play online games can compulsively and problematically replace offline relationships in favor for online action. But what makes a mental illness officially exist is its inclusion in the American Psychiatric Association's DSM, or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. The fifth edition of the DSM is being released later this year, and cyber addiction is being debated for inclusion. But although those debates have been behind closed doors, it's incredibly likely that the board won't add cyber addiction as a separate mental illness. Instead, it will probably be listed as a symptom of something more general, like depression, in exactly the same manner as overeating, overexercising, or yes, overreading. The thing that ties people who think cyber addiction is real and the geeks who say it doesn't exist is the assumption that cyber addiction is a separate illness, that somehow the technology makes it a special case. But people who today might have a problematic relationship with their phones might have, in another era, expressed their symptoms by obsessive train spotting, stamp collecting, plastic surgery, or being really into butterflies. The internet is a MacGuffin, like so many other things levied against the network. The overt behavior is just a symptom for something underlying, something more endemic. My visit to the Cyber Addiction Recovery Center left me more mindful of the ways that technology gets in the way of my work life, and also more hungry to reassert control over my relationship with it. So what if I don't respond to an email within 20 minutes of its arrival? So what if things happen on Twitter and I'm not there to see it? I've even started a piggy bank fund for a work machine that doesn't have Wi-Fi so I can switch off the compulsion to fall down a rabbit hole of, quote, research, when I already have the information in my head. The underlying mantra of this 469-square-mile megapolis is, you are broken. We can make you better. Or, as in-flight shopping catalog SkyMall might have you believe, here's the solution to the thing in your life you didn't realize was a problem. The Cyber Addiction Recovery Center is exploiting a symptom of a more modern series of problems. In this debate, the real issue isn't about the internet. It's about why people are choosing to escape there, rather than feeling comfortable enough in their offline skins to live in it.
And Alex will be back with more emails from America in the coming weeks. That's all we have here on the show. Next week, we'll be putting the new Google Chromebook Pixel, a rival to the MacBook Pro, through its paces with some surprising results. Tech Weekly was produced by me, Jason Phipps, but from Alex, Jemima, and all the tech team here at The Guardian, have a great tech Easter holiday. We'll see you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.